John Armstrong is philosopher in residence at the Melbourne Business School, and he laments that when civilization is talked about these days, which isn't often, it tends to be in the context of political tensions in different parts of the world or the horrors of colonial history. But Armstrong says civilization as a concept has much more to offer. His new book is called In Search of Civilization, Remaking a Tarnished Idea, and Paul spoke with him last week.
Now, John Armstrong, a few years ago you attended a conference in London devoted to the topic of civilization, and yet several participants argued that the idea of civilization could no longer be regarded as important. So what were their arguments? What did they say?
Well, I think they were worried about an association to the word civilization. In the second half of the 19th century, in this great era of colonial expansion, the word civilization was often used to explain why it was okay, supposedly, for industrially developed Western countries to take over and run other states around the world. And I think that the fact that civilization was used in that colonial project set up a frightening and very unhelpful association, and that the people I was listening to that particular day were in wanting to run away from that association, wanting to move away from that association. And to do that, they thought they should ditch the word civilization itself.
So their view was that civilization, it's been invoked to justify colonialism, imperialism, the white man's burden and all of that, so we should do away with it.
Yes, that's right. You, as it were, throw out the whole baby.
And this is why you say civilization is, in contemporary society, it's a tarnished idea.
I think that's right, that we tend not to have a sense that this is that civilization is an idea that we really need. And I've been interested in trying to restore, or in even more ambitious ways, trying to remake that conception so that it speaks more powerfully to the needs of the present.
Now, not only are you trying to restore it, but in your book, you define the essence of civilization as follows. Civilization occurs when a high degree of material prosperity and a high degree of spiritual prosperity come together and mutually enhance one another. Now, let's explore that. Is a high degree of material prosperity necessary for a civilized life?
It's not necessary for a good life, but I think that there's a strong drive in many people and in many societies towards material prosperity. So there's a good question to be asked around how, given that drive, we can have good lives and good society. So it's important to remember civilization is not the name for the only conceivable good society. I'm thinking of the project of trying to identify how we can combine our material drives with a really good society.
Now, if you look at material drives in your discussion of Adam Smith, you say the big point about civilization is improvement upon the way things just happen to be. It adapts nature to meet human needs. But there is a growing view, is there not, that civilization destroys and denatures life?
Well, there certainly is that anxiety. I think that anxiety can be made more precise if we remember that what we're getting at there is that the adaptions, the introduction of technology, the manipulation of nature is not really serving human needs. So I think that what people who say, oh, the project of trying to improve nature only makes things worse, they're looking at, as it were, the bad side of the equation. They're looking at the problems, which can be very real. I'm interested in remembering that there are really good uses to which capacity to control nature can be put. So for me, one of the sort of eloquent instances of civilization is the Roman aqueduct, the Pont du Gard, which is a magnificent stone structure across a river in the south of France. And it's certainly true that it transforms nature. It takes water across a river, which is naturally not possible. But it's a magnificent thing. It's a beautiful thing. And the uses to which that diverted water can be put are themselves very nice. It makes fountains and baths and things. So I think we can also remember that there are very benign instances of the manipulation of nature.
And yet in the current climate, benign instances, not talked about much. It's suggested there aren't many examples of that.
Well, look, I think there's a romanticism about which it wants to embrace the idea of nature as a way of talking about our needs. And I think that's really a contrastive concern. In a society like ours, where there's such a vast amount of technology around, we can easily get frustrated by that, and we return to some dream of nature is wise, nature is good, if only we could be more natural, and so on. But I think that that's really a request for balance. That if we did live just, you know, in the state of nature, I really don't think it would be as lovely as people suggest. And that really what those complaints about the denaturing and so on are getting at is a request for balance, I believe, between our ability to manipulate the natural world and a sense of the better purposes that we might have in so doing.
Now, looking at the state of nature and an ideal of a golden past, if you like, the question of people and population growth has been looked at by writers from the early 20th century and indeed now. And there is an orthodoxy espoused by those variously called the cultural elites or the chattering classes that them, the proletariat, the average voters, are the enemies of civilized life. Now, Matthew Arnold had something to say about that, didn't he?
Could I preface my thoughts on this by saying that in writing about civilization, I've been very conscious of the fact that it's an enormous public notion, and it's very easy to fall into the, I believe, trap of saying, oh, here's what they should do. That is, here's what governments should do. Here's what all the people in the world should do, or all the people in one society. But I don't think a book really functions that way. A book is, to my mind, a more intimate object. It speaks more to the private life of the reader. So I'm slightly cautious about the thought that a book should come up with a recipe for an idealized United Nations and tell us, you know, what the birth control population, birth control policy of the world should be, and that sort of thing. Look, I think, having said that, I think that Arnold is onto something very important. He wanted to see a broadening of the community of people who were involved in thinking about the way a country should be run. But he felt that to do that, you needed to have quite a lot of internal development. You needed to have contact with important, enriching ideas. And so he wanted to bring more people into the world of sophisticated culture. So rather than being, as it were, a terrifying lament, oh no, the wider world, the wider population are so ignorant. Arnold, I think, was trying to inspire us to the task of good education, which is to help people, to equip people to take on more responsibility, to deal well with freedom. And it seems to me that puts a rather different gloss on his words, which they can sound as if it's a, you know, just a terrible lamentation.
Now, thinking of deep needs and the possible civilising role for governments, you say it is the responsibility of the state to provide for, or at least not interfere with, the development of the individual. I have a worry about our elected politicians believing that they can pull levers and make us more civilised. Is that not a carte blanche for programmes of political correctness?
Well, it seems to me political correctness is a mistake in attempting to undertake that kind of governmental role. Political correctness is often devoted to the externals of what people say and do. Look, I share the worry about governments trying to take on too much of a moral role because they're not really very well equipped to do so. The underlying point, however, is that the qualities of character and mind that civilization speaks of, we might call them, you know, wisdom, quality of relationships, appreciation of beauty, and so on, don't join up all that closely with the kinds of policy issues that governments have to be concerned with. My sense is that we shouldn't look to governments for direct advocacy here. We shouldn't have, the Ministry of Love or the governmental department of beauty and wisdom, tempting though in a sort of fantasy way that would be. I think the issues actually take place a couple of steps back. In thinking through what governments are trying to accomplish, there are lots of ways in which quality of relationships, quality of the built environment, kinds of educational principles and so on are built into the functioning of the state. And I suppose my view is that governments can play some kind of role, but I really don't think that it's in a sense primarily something we should look to governments to accomplish. I'm afraid I'm a bit ambivalent about this. In some moods, I want to say yes, government can do a lot. In others, I want to say no, perhaps it's really more a matter for civil society, that is for individuals.
Well, I don't think you're being ambivalent. You're just expressing the dilemma that we have. If we believe in civilising institutions, the question we're exploring is who drives that civilising force? Now, I want to raise a question with you. Some would say civilization means civil society. If the goal of governments or institutions, if the goal was to express and empower the best self, some would say this would lead to an increase in civility. And I want to give you a quote. It's from the screenplay of The Third Man, and it's the Harry Lime character. I'm sure you know this.
Yes,
he lays
yes.
down the challenge and he says, "In Italy, for 30 years under the Borgias, they had warfare, terror, murder and bloodshed. But they produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci and the Renaissance. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love. They had 500 years of democracy and peace. And what did they produce? The cuckoo clock." So the question is, does civility, on your understanding, entail harmony?
It's a really fascinating quote, isn't it? But I'm very suspicious of it. You see, I don't believe for a moment that Harry Lime cares about the Renaissance. I don't believe that he cares about Michelangelo. The puzzling thing here is that very often people want to refer to great cultural ideals which don't really go deep with them. And so the contrast is to some extent a spurious one. The role of civility isn't just to make us passive and obedient and quiet and so on. I think that the real point is civility is to do with understanding other people, having a sense of dignity and purpose in one's own life, having a sense of the potential of human interaction. And I think that if we look more deeply at movements like the Renaissance or at great art, the work of great artists, they're often speaking to that sense of human potential. When we just say, oh, the Renaissance, we're thinking probably of almost like a sort of tourist trip. We're just sort of wandering around some city, and what does it really mean deep down? Not very much. But if we look more closely at the things that people really cared about and try to internalize those a bit more, I think they do join up with civility, and therefore that the contrast that Harry Lime is so excited by, in fact, I think doesn't really, it's slightly sort of made up.
It was made up, and in fact it was written by Orson Welles, that line. It wasn't written by Graham Greene. But I'm interested in this idea of human potential because in looking at the civilizing function of contemporary art, you proclaim mockery, irony and archness are not what we need. What's gone wrong with contemporary art?
I think that it has set out on slightly the wrong mission. A lot of the background to contemporary art excitement is the idea that we're trying to cast off some sort of burden of oppression and regimentation, and we need this sort of dramatic freeing process. I think that would have been a very, very good project round about 1901. In fact, that project, the project of liberation, has, at least in the sophisticated parts of the West, actually been completed a long time ago. Our great tasks now, it seems to me, are to find stable and serious principles of order, harmony, depth, beauty, human dignity, and so on. And I think that really requires a very, very different take on what the role of art might be. And I'm hoping that that artists will catch up with that a bit more.
Yes, it's not a popular view at the moment. I mean, you've made the point that a popular stance is that high culture is to provoke and distress the ruling class, to, as it were, trash those beastly bourgeoisies. And it's very common, isn't it?
That's a fantasy, really. It's imagining that out there are all these well-heeled people who spend all their time thinking about the Renaissance and the high art of the past and so on. I just think that's a complete fantasy. That the project that got a lot of people interested in the transformational power of art was really a 19th century one. It really got going in France in the second half of the 19th century, where there seemed to be a very, very entrenched dominant class that also owned traditional art. Now, there was a struggle against that. That struggle was completely successful. I think that by the end of the Second World War, that project was completely finished. It was completely achieved. But for some reason, that attitude to art has kind of survived and continues as a myth, and so generates a very unhelpful sense of what art is for.
Now, John Armstrong, you are, and this is a wonderful job description, you'll make many of our listeners jealous, you are philosopher in residence at the Melbourne Business School, and you say business, education and the arts all have the same final trajectory, the promotion of civilization. Some might respond that the word business just doesn't fit in there. So how do you see business promoting civilization?
To start with, I see business as the name for a very, very large part of ordinary human activity, which is commerce, trading, markets, the production and distribution of the things that people want to buy and need. So I don't think we should see business just as, you know, the snapshot of exactly the economy we have, you know, this minute. Business is the name of a very, very large, basic and potentially very good human, the organization of human effort. So I don't think that there can be any profound worry that business should play an important role in civilization. I think that I'm trying to identify something of an ideal, that the immense efforts and organization that go under the name of business can serve people's true needs just as much as they could serve as they can serve our trivial needs. What is tricky there is that business is tremendously demand oriented. So we tend to get the businesses that, and the commercial environment that, in a sense, we ask for. And I think what's so tricky, so sometimes so painful, is admitting that it's because of what we want that the business world is as it is. If people wanted different things, the business world would respond. So I see that there's a as it were, a compact between the commercial realm and culture. Culture is the arena where people's longings and desires and demands are generated. And business, in a sense, meets those. So if we want to have a more, if we want business to contribute better to civilization, we have to bring better demands to the commercial world.
What you're saying is we have to learn to articulate our true needs.
Yes, to recognise them and to demand them.
Thank you very much for talking to Counterpoint.
Thank you very much indeed.
Associate Professor John Armstrong is Philosopher in Residence at the Melbourne Business School and Senior Advisor to the Vice-Chancellor of Melbourne University. His book, In Search of Civilization, Remaking a Tarnished Idea, is published locally by Penguin Books.